Thank you, folks. Have a seat. Give us just a moment to get set up. All right. And good morning again. We're here for oral arguments in case number 1, CACV 250718 FC, Riddle v. Sosnowski. Folks, these proceedings are being videotaped and audio recorded as well as live streamed. So when you approach the podium to speak, we do ask that you please state your name and identify your client so that everybody, whether here in the courtroom or elsewhere, knows who you are representing from the beginning of your argument. Each of you will have 20 minutes to argue your side. Counsel, for the appellant, you are responsible for maintaining and tracking any portion that you wish to retain for rebuttal. We won't protect it for you, but if you tell us, we'll at least try and remind you if we notice that you're encroaching on it. Of course, you don't need to use the 20 minutes, but please use the time that you think are available. I mention that because we have read the briefs. We have conferenced the case previously this morning, so we are very familiar with the facts and the record. So with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Steve Evers on behalf of the appellant, Dr. Jennifer Sosnowski, is with us. And I have also my co-counsel, David Ferrucci, who's helped in assistance in the drafting of the briefs. I want to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal, if that's okay. I don't have to be motivated any more than I presently am in order to advocate for my client in this particular case. I believe the relief that we've requested is not only legal, but it is the right thing to do. The good news is that you don't have to make any decisions with regard to resolving the whole issue. You just have to decide whether or not we go back to the trial court. I'm requesting that you vacate the decree based upon the Rule 69 agreement that was entered, or alternatively remand the case for a hearing to decide the issues on due process, duress, coercion, impossibility, impracticality, mistake, and fairness. Those are all the issues that have been raised. I'd like to begin by setting the stage for what I think is a background to what happened in connection with this case, and that is a background with regard to a Rule 69 mediation session. You have, first of all, a mediator. They are paid in connection with each case. They attend dozens, if not hundreds, of mediations. They're in charge of what takes place, generally speaking, in connection with the mediations. They are paid to get an agreement, generally speaking, and if they don't, their marketing becomes adversely impacted in many instances. Then you have counsel for both of the parties that are attending the mediation. They have attended many also. They also want to get an agreement for a different reason. They want to get an agreement because it means they don't have to go to trial and do the pretrial statement and the witness outlines and all the exhibits that have to be done and everything else. But both lawyers and the mediator have an objective in mind. There's nothing wrong with the objective. It just means that that's the objective that they have when they start, and they lean towards that. So to a certain degree, they have a built-in bias when they start about getting an agreement at all costs when they go. The clients, on the other hand,
that's a pretty heavy assumption to make, because not all lawyers go into the mediation fighting for an agreement. I think most people can recognize that they have seen settlement conferences where the goal was to not settle.
There are times when parties go into it, or lawyers, when they don't intend to settle. That's for sure.
And so we can't say, and I guess I'm in a little trouble because it suggests that there's an adversarial relationship between the lawyer and their own client. And I don't think you're trying to do that, because I think they can align, and they do align in many ways.
They do align. I don't disagree with the court. There are times when lawyers have a different opinion about what happens in the mediation as opposed to the client, and you're absolutely right about that. And they will vary from time to time as to what objective that they really want. Lots of times clients will say, I don't want to go to mediation. I want to go straight to the judge. And a lot of times lawyers will say, no, let's go to mediation first, because anything we can do to try to solve this case would be better in the first place. The point I wanted to make out is that, contrary to the lawyers and to the mediator, the clients go into mediation and they're there for the very first time. They've never probably been at any mediation in any time in the past. They have no experience about what goes on. They don't understand the process often. They don't understand lengths of time. They don't know the rules about continuances or extra time or any of the other things that go on. They don't know about asking if they can have a day to review paperwork. They're dealing with issues that they worried about all the way up to the day of the mediation, sometimes, as in this case, for several years before the mediation takes place. And it takes care of issues that they're going to be solving for the rest of their lives with their children, with all their assets, their debts, and other things that take place. So I just think that is a deal of the backdrop of what goes on in connection with this particular case, and that's part of the understanding that I want to bring to the court's attention.
Counsel, I understand what you're saying. I just have a problem because the assumptions that you're suggesting that we make is that lawyers are going into a mediation not advocating for their clients, which they have an ethical obligation to do. And I understand that, you know, lawyers have opinions about cases, but their job is to represent their clients. And we're not here to talk about the representation during that wasn't raised in the briefs at all during this. I'm just a little bit concerned that you're painting this broad brush that lawyers are going into mediations not representing their clients, and I'm just a little hesitant to buy into that.
And I'm not trying to intimidate that lawyers go into it trying to do something different than what their clients' objectives are. I'm trying to set the stage for a way. I have experienced most mediations that take place, and the ones that I deal with it when I act as a mediator as well as as an attorney and with clients for years.
So perhaps we focus on the facts of this case and where you think it went off, because we're not globally saying that all these mediations are subject to attack. There's got to be a basis in law, yes. And you've alleged several. So why don't we really focus on the specific?
We'll do, and I'll take those in the order of importance as they're addressed in the brief. First one has to do with due process. In this particular case, mother's filed affidavits of 21 pages and father filed affidavits of 3 pages of disputed facts in connection with what happened during the mediation in all of these areas, including duress, impossibility, impracticality, mistake, unfairness, and so on and so forth. We've cited case law to this court already with regard to the Volk case and with regard to the Solorzano case, both of which are right on point authorities for the fact that disputed issues of fact have to be resolved by the court in a hearing. In this particular case, that's what should have been done at the time. Many of you may know Judge Talamanca used to sit on the southeast bench out in Mesa. He was known for some of the comments that he used to say to counsel when they would come in. One of the ones I remember him saying is, if a party says we have a deal and the other side says we don't have a deal, then we don't have a deal because you don't have one.
The situation here. We had both parties sign a Rule 69 agreement with language in it that said they knowingly entered this. They had authority to do it. I mean, the language in this agreement is very telling in terms of what the parties were agreeing to. So it's really hard for me to understand how you overcome that, because in a Rule 69 agreement, I mean, it's binding on the parties when they sign it. I understand what you're saying. Your client feels like, you know, she had all of these issues that occurred. But I'm just struggling to find in the record, and I'd love you to point it to me, as to exactly where during the mediation she brought up any of these issues, suggested that she didn't have the capacity to sign an agreement, because the burden – your client's burden to show that this agreement isn't binding is really high.
I'll get there in just a moment if you'll let me say a couple of things as I begin. When we were talking about the stage of mediation, let me reference also one thing. In this particular case, the mediation lasted 12 straight hours, and there were no court proceedings. I just want to make sure you're aware. We don't have 12-hour trials. We don't have 12-hour anything on any single day. This is a legal proceeding that lasted much longer than what would normally be done. I also want to bring your attention to a note. There were emails between counsel that are referenced in father's lawyer's memorandum in this case, where the lawyers and the mediator communicated the day after the mediation. And you may remember that the email said this. They mentioned that it had been a long. This was the day after. They had been there for a long day. Both of them mentioned twice that it was for a long day, but we got it done! Exclamation point. That confirms the same idea I'm saying, and that is the objective of mediation is to get a deal if you can get one at all costs.
I'm sorry, Mr. Everts. I'd really like an answer to Judge Foster's question, and really this the part two to that question is if there was an issue that happened during the mediation, and I hope you can address this, is why wasn't it brought up earlier?
Okay.
So what happened during the mediation? What in the record shows us that there were issues that happened during the mediation that were brought up during the mediation? And even if they weren't brought up then, why weren't these issues brought up the next day or 2 days later?
Okay. I can't answer all of those questions. I can tell you that Mother told her counsel when she showed up at 8:30 that morning what had happened to her during the night, which was, and I'm not going to reiterate the facts because we don't have time for all that. Basically, we have a lady who's sick, who's coming to mediation with migraine headaches, not regular headaches, migraine headaches, that adversely impacted her ability to both comprehend and understand what was going on in connection with the proceedings that whole entire day. Everything that's in a written document where she signs it is compromised because she's not dealing with a full deck at the time that she enters into all those agreements and not understanding all of those agreements that were there.
Is there anything in the record that showed that either the mediator or husband's counsel was aware of any of that?
There's nothing in the record that I know of from counsel, and there's a reason why that happens. Sometimes counsel doesn't disclose that to the other side or to the mediator because it impacts adversely their ability to negotiate during the day because they think they're now operating at a compromised position. So they don't maybe tell everybody about whether their client is ill and not able to function as much as she should. She will tell you, and her affidavit is very clear, that she told her lawyer about what had happened during the night and why she was not operating at full capacity that day. That is in the record.
Let me ask, because it wasn't just the next day or the next couple of days, it got lodged without objection. It got approved without objection. This went for a long time with no suggestion that there was a problem. How do we deal with that? Because I'm struggling with that part. You know, how do we deal with that delay? And I guess my first question, though, is there's no allegation that the terms of Rule 69 were met, is there? Beyond the fact that you say there was fraud or coercion, but the Rule 69, the letter of Rule 69 was met, facially.
The document says what it says. You're right. It's there.
Okay.
It was deposited. It was done on the 14th, if I recall correctly, of April, and by the end of April, then the document was actually entered by a different judge, and then it became an order of the court. Mother, during that period of time, of course, the delay was caused because Mother was trying to find a new lawyer. She didn't feel as though she was adequately represented at mediation for whatever reasons. It's her to call. And so she interviewed three different lawyers, finally came to my office, at which time we filed within the 25 days the objection to the order that granted the entry of the Rule 69 agreement. Along with that, the decree wasn't entered again for another month or so after that, and but she, in my opinion, she acted as timely as she could under the circumstances, not having counsel that she was going to be relying on and having to try to find a new one that was going to take on a case now that already showed what appeared on its face as a valid and binding Rule 69 agreement.
Any evidence in the record that she directed her former counsel, and I understand that she had lost confidence, to not file it, to not proceed, to file an objection or to do something?
No, not to my knowledge.
How do you respond to your friend on the other side's argument that there were a lot of steps taken by Mother and perhaps her former counsel, I don't remember who it was, that were consistent with the agreement, including asking for multiple extensions to come up with the $100,000 payment?
Well, for one thing, the order didn't get lodged until the end of that month, and there were only 19 days left until the payment was due. So the amount of time, and I could spend an hour talking about that $100,000, but the $100,000 was due too quickly in this particular case. One of the arguments we made on the impossibility of performance is that the facts and the circumstances of that order already tell us that it was going to be her dad that made the payment because you couldn't go out and get a loan. You couldn't borrow money. There was no evidence in this record as to whether or not Mother had the ability or the capacity.
No evidence that she couldn't either.
Well, the evidence is implied from all the facts in this case because she's got a payment that's due to husband of over $500,000. She's got debts on the books of $250,000. Who's going to give her a loan under those circumstances if she takes that document on its face and gives it to a lender and say, give me another $100,000, I've got to have it? By the way, The facts are also here because they're implied. Dad had already given her $100,000 before, and it had been paid off.
Well, but counsel, in as far as the record and the document, it was never made contingent. There was no suggestion that if she couldn't do it, something else would happen beyond the property would be sold. So she understood in entering the agreement that this was what would happen. I mean, it's not ambiguous. There's not something that was done that wasn't part of the agreement. You either come up with a loan, which isn't specified as to father. She could have even done that. Or, and it could have been that, and if that doesn't happen, then the deal is off. I mean, that's how these things can be set up.
Well, if you're starting with the assumption, Your Honor, that she has to get $100,000 from her dad, and her dad isn't going
well,
to do it.
She has to get $100,000 from someone. That's the assumption under the agreement. That's all the agreement says.
On its face, you're right. Yeah. But there's facts that are outside of that that are in this record based upon the affidavits. Father stated to mother 2 weeks after mediation, quote, I knew your dad wouldn't go through with it. That's in mother's affidavit on page 7, line 21. At 7/10/25, father knew that she was going to consult with her dad in order to get the money, but he didn't tell her any of that, and he didn't disclose it to her, even though that was an implied assumption by both parties at the time that they entered into this agreement. It had to be because there's no other source of money, and she didn't have any money. Nobody can identify one single place in this whole document where there's $100,000 that she can use to pay off father. Zero.
Did she try?
Say that one more time.
Did she try? Any evidence that she tried?
Not before her dad told her no. And not between that date and hiring me in order to try to argue against it, no.
And has she tried? I mean, did she ever try to get a loan?
She has tried, and even to this day, Your Honor, and hasn't had one. That's not in the record, but that's part of the truth. I know my time is getting fairly limited, so I want to make sure and bring a few points to the court's attention. Not only did I talk about the emails and that, there's some things that I think are important. By the way, her ability to ask for additional time or a continuance under the circumstances, I wanted to bring to your attention that the burden is not on the person who's coming there to do the settlement. It's on the mediator. It's on counsel in order to do that. I would point out in father's response, page 8, lines, paragraph 16, father's counsel states that this mediator had a prior mediation 2 weeks prior to the filing of the response in this case, during which this very same mediator recognized the party's inability to focus and requested that the other side keep the offer open for 36 to 72 hours to avoid the exact situation that mother experienced in this case. Those should have been offered to her, and they were blatantly omitted from this particular record of giving her a chance to continue or take the documents home, which she has testified in her affidavit she would have done immediately. Since I don't have a whole lot of time, I'll just tell you we've outlined the documents and the arguments very clearly with regard to impossibility and impracticality. I've quoted what Father stated there. I wanted to point out with you with regard to the fairness and the meekness, the fairness and the reasonableness arguments on the division of the property, because we've outlined all the problems with the division of the property, that in the Meek case, which was cited by Father in their brief, that the trial court had a fairness hearing in that case, just exactly like we're asking this court to grant us right now. Based upon that, I'll reserve
counsel,
the rest of my time.
I just
time.
Want to ask,
oh,
but
yes, ma'am.
Under Meek, was it required that the court have it? Because our standard of review is abuse of discretion as to whether the court abused its discretion. And that's, again, you know, you've got to show that the court acted improperly in not having it, and I don't read Meek to say that it was an obligation that the court do it.
No, but we know we've cited cases that do say it is an obligation of the court to determine fairness and determine the other issues. They're all contract offenses, which are justifiably raised in connection with the Rule 69 agreement, and that in this particular case, the disputed issues of fact, you can't resolve them without having the credibility of the parties testify. And in this case, when you've got competing affidavits on 24 different pages of affidavits that are almost all diametrically opposed, how can you do it without having a hearing? That's the mandatory requirement. On a Rule 69 agreement by the court has to make that finding. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What I'll do is let's give one more minute to both counsels, since we did chew up some of the time there that you were trying to reserve.
Thank you.
A minute good, or do you want
two? May it please the court, My name is Amy Wilkins Hoffman, and I represent Appellee Larry Riddle. The court had some questions about the record today, so I'd like to address some of those. Let's look at the record. The mediation was on April 14th. The next day, there are emails, everybody's happy, there's no objection. On the 17th, husband's counsel lodges the Rule 69 agreement. On the 24th, wife asks for arbitration to divide the personal property issue. She doesn't say this was under duress. She doesn't say I had a bad headache. She doesn't say that this is unfair. She's going with the agreement. And what she also doesn't do is she doesn't object to the lodging of the Rule 69 agreement. It gets lodged on the 28th of April. Only after...
Can I just interrupt? That 24th email that you're talking about where she asked for arbitration?
Yes.
Was that her counsel asking for that, or was that wife asking separately outside of her counsel?
I don't recall.
Okay,
off the top of my head. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I know there were emails in husband's brief that responded to the Rule 83 motion that set those out, and that's where I took that fact from.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Only after the Rule 69 order is entered does wife indicate she's having trouble finding the money. Now, we talked about it's not grandpa's obligation to give her the money in the contract. It just says $100,000 from somewhere. But it also has a contingency. If you can't pay, you sell the house. And that's what this case is about. It's not about mediation being inherently coercive or that parties can't make their own deals in mediation because the system is stacked against them. It's just that wife didn't want to sell the house, because that was something she could perform. She asked for more time. Husband gave her more time. Her counsel, Judith Morris, was her counsel during all this time. She did not withdraw until July 18th, 2025. So let's talk about some of these.
Just the contingency and what we're talking about is not an uncommon, I'm going to say double negative, it's a very common term. Where one of the parties wants to keep a house and they're going to do what they can to keep it. So this is not some extraordinary or unusual provision. We see it in many different decisions from this court talking about this was the provision, they had to refinance or whatever, and there was a way to do it. And am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely correct. Because this happens. Couples sometimes don't leave with the same resources they had when they were married. You divide the resources. Here, they divided it so that wife would keep the house, husband would get his fair equity, and he wanted some money up front. That couldn't happen because she couldn't get the loan, so there was a solution. Put it up for market. And that's when the trouble started.
And I waited a few moments giving you a chance to walk through, but why not give a hearing? I mean, that's the big thing. Why not give a hearing in this case when we do have competing facts? I mean, the hearing can result in the same outcome, but why not give a hearing? And why was it as counsel argues, that it was unreasonable not to, that no reasonable judge wouldn't have given a hearing. Why was it reasonable to say no hearing?
It's reasonable for several reasons. One, legally, wife didn't, and let's analogize to summary judgment, didn't meet her burden of production. Let's look at duress. We look at the legal definition of duress, a wrongful act by the other party where the other person felt they had no ability to remove themselves from the situation. That's kind of a loose definition. She didn't have facts in her affidavit saying that was the case. She could have walked out. She had counsel. It was a mediation. This wasn't, you know, some gunpoint situation with a very experienced mediator. That's not duress. The judge could look at that, at her affidavit, compare it to the definition of duress and say, I don't need to have a hearing on this. Same for impossibility. It was not impossible for performance. And again, the standard is not whether wife could perform. I'm not saying wife had $100,000 in her checking account. The standard is whether anyone could perform. So not having the funds you thought you were going to have doesn't mean we can all go around saying it's impossible for me to perform this contract.
Which would undermine a lot of those conditions that we regularly review and affirm.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Could have looked at mistake. Is this a unilateral mistake? No, there's no evidence in the record that husband, you know, had this nefarious knowledge that she was definitely going to have to sell that house because her father wouldn't pay. That's not what the contract said. It said $100,000 or sell the house. That has nothing to do with husband's knowledge. And if I had a nickel for every time I said that I knew something, you know, my husband didn't, I'd have many nickels. So to me, that sounds like spouses.
On that point, what, if anything, are we to make of the statement that was in wife's affidavit about, I guess it was 2 weeks after the agreement is signed, husband saying, I knew your father, something to the effect of, I knew your father was never going to give you the money. Is that meaningful in any way? Should that affect our analysis?
You know, here's how I would approach that. A unilateral mistake has to be a unilateral mistake of fact. Whether or not wife's father was going to perform is not a mistake of fact. It was maybe an assumption wife had that he was going to help her out. Father may have had an assumption that probably not. But that's why they put in the contract, if it doesn't work, if you don't get the money, then we'll sell the house. I think it was covered by the party's agreement. And we also don't want to take away the party's ability to make their own contracts in mediation. Because, you know, that when I was listening to Mr. Everts talk about the coercive nature of mediation, I thought, but we want mediation to help people get to yes without a court, a judge telling them, well, here's the terms. Here's the terms of your agreement. And
the classic good settlement is where both sides leave unhappy, is, I believe, a term. It's a saying, some would say, for a reason.
Yes. And when we talk about fairness, because I know we want to talk about why they didn't get a hearing. So my argument on the contractual defenses is simply didn't meet her burden as a matter of law. Like, legally, the court could just go, no. Let's talk about fairness. Mr. Everts brought up the...
Before you move off of duress, because I want to focus on something. Mr. Everts mentioned that this same mediator in another mediation conditioned the final resolution on giving the both sides, or at least one side, a couple of days. One, is that in the record anywhere?
It's in husband's response to the Rule 83 motion, and Ms. Holder brought it up as just something like, I've worked with this mediator before. These are possibilities that happen in mediation.
And in that regard, what do we do with the fact that he didn't hear? It seems to me there are two inferences that could be drawn from it. One, he didn't see it at all and there was no need, or it was there and he just didn't see it. But I think we infer that if he had observed anything that gave him concern, that's something he would have done here.
I think we could infer that. I also think that wife had experienced counsel, and if her client was unable to proceed or having trouble or acting strangely after, you know, they did spend 11 hours together, wife's counsel could have asked for that.
So there's two places it could have, that's part of where I'm coming from. There's two places, Mr. Sarasano or Ms. Morse. Either one could have done that.
Either one could have done that. Wife could have said, I'm a medical doctor, I can't continue, and walked out. So three sources. Now, fairness, I want to talk about the Meat case a little bit. That was a Judge McMurdy case, 2023. And in the Meat case, Judge McMurdy said, we're not going to apply the 25318 standard to settlement agreements. We aren't going to ask if it's inequitable. We're going to ask if it's fair. And while those two words seem the same, they've been interpreted slightly differently. A judge is going to look at the party's property division and say, is this equitable, meaning roughly equal in most cases. Fair is something that the parties can come up with. We're going to give some deference to the parties. The person challenging it has the burden. And in this case, what the trial court had in front of it was a record. It had the property settlement agreement that hadn't been objected to. It had the parties' briefing and affidavits that did not have anything to do with credibility. The affidavits had to do with duress and mistake and the contract defenses, but only a few things about fairness. Wife didn't like the valuation of her business, and the affidavit said, well, she could have gotten another valuation in the 2 years prior to this mediation, and she negotiated the value. to the middle so that she could accept her debt. She didn't like the value of the cars. She actually got more. So the judge had enough evidence, and this is like the Huttke case. In Sharp, circumstances much different, and this court said, no, you need an evidentiary hearing because there are issues, hotly disputed issues of fact. In Huttke, this court said, no, not every time, only if the court doesn't have enough record evidence in front of it to make a decision. And that's what happened here. I've never tried to do this on my laptop before. I apologize. Another issue that was not brought up, I believe, in the briefs necessarily, except maybe in passing, is waiver. Husband lodged the Rule 69 agreement on April 17th, and wife did not object to it. The court entered it on April 28th, 2025, and wife filed a Rule 83 motion. Now, this court has a lot of case law saying if you don't give the trial court the opportunity in the first instance to resolve your issue, then we don't look at it on a Rule 83, at least on appeal. So I would argue that wife waived it by not objecting to the Rule 69 lodging, which she had the opportunity to do when she was represented by counsel in doing so.
But we're not required to waive. We could decide to reach the issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's a discretionary call.
Or you could write a really short decision on that issue instead, because there was a waiver. And then it would have to be under Rule 83 because fairness is not resolved under Rule 85. And that is, it's a memorandum decision, but it's Thomas v. Thomas, and that's a 2026 case of this court. Unless the court has any other questions, I think I've hit on all of my topics through your questions.
I think we're good.
Okay, thanks so much.
So you gave me my extra minute, it looks like. Thank you.
Perhaps focus on why a hearing. Why does it have to be a hearing?
It has to be a hearing because there are contested issues of fact that involve credibility that are stated in multiple affidavits. I like the question you asked Judge Goss when you says, why not have a hearing in this case? That's exactly what I would like to ask. Why didn't the court simply hold a hearing? Under any logical cost-benefit analysis in this case, that would have been much better than having to go through, wait another year, and do a whole appeal that could have been solved with a simple hearing to decide the issues of fact and credibility that should have been held in connection with this case. This is bigger than most cases that you'll see with regard to the issues of fact. There's questions about whether or not she was capable of making the agreements health-wise. There's issues with regard to impossibility. And I do want to mention the point about due process right in the opening part of our brief. Due process challenges are reviewed de novo. So you can make the ruling that it is bad and that the due process applies in this case. And that's exactly what should be applied to say that this agreement didn't comply with due process because mother never had an opportunity to present the evidence that she wanted to present with regard to the validity of that agreement. A couple of other points that I would just mention in rebuttal. With regard to mother trying to do some of the things and waiver and ratification and argument that's raised, nobody would punish somebody for trying to do what they could do that is not in dispute. I would point out to the court, if you've got issues with regard to parenting time and legal decision making, you're not going to make those wait until you get this whole issue resolved for a year on appeal while you go ahead and solve some of those issues or try to deal with those things. You can piecemeal your agreement and challenge the things that need to be challenged. The duress is mentioned in the restatement. It's not only required to be bilateral, it can be unilateral, and it's mentioned that in the restatement is the one that says what the test is, and it's whether the result was produced by means that seriously impaired the free, competent exercise of judgment. And then they cited the Odorizzi case, which is out of California. But anyway, they still mention the same factors, but it's the restatement that's the basis of mother's argument in this case, that there was duress and coercion sufficient enough to invalidate the agreement. This is not a case of buyer's remorse. She woke up the next morning, and she didn't say, I want to get out of this agreement. She says, what did I do? And the reason she said, what did I do, is because she didn't even remember what happened the day before. or what the agreement was. And when she finally read it and then asked her dad and he wouldn't pay the $100,000, bingo, that's what happened. Now, she didn't tell her lawyer, you screwed up or this. She started seeking other counsel in order to try to address the issue because she knew she wasn't going to get relief from the person that already was complicit in doing the same thing that had been done. When you're sick, by the way.
It seems to me that this is more an issue between her and her counsel and whether the counsel did something inappropriate, although, again, it seems clear she didn't even ask counsel to correct the issue that she saw, rather than an issue for the court to be deciding with regard to a Rule 69 agreement.
Yeah,
I'll give you time to answer that question.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but there isn't anything in the record talking about the attorney-client privilege information that went on between mother and her counsel in terms of what she was asking them to do in this particular case. So we can't address what it was. I suspect she had lost faith, as we talked about before, and then ended up seeking other counsel. Had to go to three different lawyers, as her affidavit states, in order to find one, which was me, that believed she had some reasons to set this agreement aside. My time is up. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the argument. And we appreciate the thoughtfulness of it. We've got a lot to think about, obviously. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our ruling in due course. We are going to stand at recess to set up for the next oral argument.